and take whatever therapy.
It's a numbers game. The godfather of go-go, Chuck Brown, an icon in the world of popular music, especially in Washington, D.C., where he was based, was a songwriter, guitarist, band leader, and general consciousness-raising singer. That was the kind of music that he did. This particular song is on the Thievery Corporation's new album. Chuck Brown died of pneumonia in 2012. He was 75 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and hopefully you have transitioned, done that time transition over the weekend, and you're well adjusted now to the hour. It's, yes, it is after one, not after two. It's after one. All right. Today is the last day of this great and wonderful, that's what they say, political contest. It's called the midterm elections. It's the election that is held at the midway point of a president's term in office. Donald Trump has been in office for 2 years as president. So this year marks the midterm elections. And so they've been going on quite briskly and quite controversially, I must add, as well. We've been talking about from your perspective and my perspective, we've been talking about how we regard these elections. What are we supposed to think and do with respect to the midterm elections? And today, our conversation will take the shape of answering a question. From your point of view, what do you see as the most significant thing about this election? What do you see as the most significant thing about this election? There are all kinds of predictions as to how it will go. The prediction generally is that the Republicans may hold on to the Senate while the Democrats will take the House. Nobody knows. But that's the prediction that is shared by many well-thought-of political analysts. And, you know, these people who do this for a living, this is what they see. The Republicans holding on to the Senate by a very narrow margin, and the Democrats taking the House. There you go. Six of one and half a dozen of the other. I don't mean to make light of this. It's just that I have an entirely different take on elections in general in the United States. I wish they were what they said they were going to be, and what they aimed to be, which was a true picture of the democratic process, where the people become involved in the process of governance and government and choosing their government. But there's so many depressing drawbacks. For example, as we speak, there's thousands of Native Americans who cannot vote and will not be able to vote because of some quirky thing that they just decided to implement, where voters should have a house number. And that's not the way they've been living. They've never had house numbers assigned, to their addresses. Their mail came to mailboxes. That's the way it's always been. But for some reason now, they've come up with this idea that they must have a house address, and if you don't have a house address, that disqualifies you. All these nasty little things that they're doing to nullify the vote, which tells you there's something called fear that is running rampant. The idea that these communities that are simply just trying to do what they are assured that they should be doing as citizens, and all kinds of things are going on to nullify the vote. I find it very distressing. And it seems to be okay with both sides. I don't see the Democrats. The Democrats should have been railing about this for quite some time now, but not the people are left to fight this battle by themselves, as if they can change what is now the law. They can't change the law, and the people who can are preoccupied with other things. The last thing that they're concerned about, Republican and Democrats alike, is that they should get off the track of what they're about to deal with a real conflict here, a real constitutional question. So these things, you see them happening, the way they're gerrymandering districts, the way they arbitrarily are shutting down polling sites, the way they are discouraging people from voting, the lying, the fear-mongering, all of this is going on. And it's because it is never going to be a fair fight. It's not a fair fight. I have a problem with that. It's like a bunch of thugs pretending to be, on the up and up. But a lot of thuggery is going on. We've had a president who, for months now, essentially has not been at work. He's busy holding rallies. This is what the people are paying the president and his cabinet members and everybody else who's on the campaign trail. Is that what they're paying them to do? It is upsetting. Very upsetting. But that's just me. It just adds to the stench of politics and gives you one more reason why, you just don't want, you can't feel comfortable sinking this low and deliberately ignoring all of the indications that this is not a free and fair election process. But they'll tell us that, and they'll insist that we believe it to be so. But in any event, our charge today, via your calls, would be to address the following question. What do you see as the most significant thing about this election? Good, bad, and indifferent, what do you see as the most significant thing about it? And how does it figure into your notion of what the democratic process, that's a small d, democratic process ought to be, electoral process, the part where the people come in as a kind of independent force to exert their will and to literally put their hands on the helm of government for just a bit, just a short bit, to determine what our leadership would be. And therefore, we would have fulfilled the demand being made of us to be part of this process. As I told you, I have problems with it. And you know, it may sound like I'm being idealistic, but I don't think it is idealistic to expect a free and fair election. I don't think it's idealistic to expect that historically oppressed people continue to be historically oppressed. They do all kinds of things to short circuit the power of the vote and the vote itself. And for me, as I told you, I'm kind of at a distance. I'm not buying into the election. As just I'm not. Something else has to happen. I have to see some indication that somewhere in this crazy contest, there is some kind of recognition that people are trying their best in the within the constraints, you know, that they're dealing with to shore up a process, to participate in it, to give it a to sanitize it, to give it a to remove the stench of corruption and, you know, all the shenanigans that go on. Aimed directly, mostly at people of color in this country. So I'd be interested to hear what you think is the most significant thing about this election at 888-874-4888, and what you think the implications are. Whatever it is you think is the most, one of the most significant things about this election. What are the implications of that thing that you identify in the big picture of things? All right, so that's where we're going today. 888-874-4888, just to give you an update. There are news reports that as the so-called caravan of migrants inches toward the US border, the southern border with Mexico, that there are groups, militia groups, US-based militia groups, getting ready to be armed at the border, ostensibly to serve as, I guess, to supplement any military presence at the border that Trump has ordered. You see where this is going. You see where this is going. It is not a nice time. It's not a good time. And the fact that we don't have yet a means of really containing this president, and we don't have yet a means of saying what we recognize pointing to what it is we recognize. And what we recognize is that this president is doing everything possible to fracture this country, to do all kinds of rallying to force war. This, in his view, shores up his popularity and authority, and certainly the whole idea of white supremacy. So we don't know what is going to come of this armed militia getting themselves organized at the border. We'll see. 888-874-4888. CC from New Jersey, what would you say is the most significant thing to you about this election?
Well, first, let me say you are liked, loved, appreciated, and your show rocks. And
thank
I have
you.
To say thank you to the Lead Stories leaders, LEADERS. What's most significant in my view is that the Democrats, which I'm going to vote for, and that's because I let them slide for 40, 50 years. We've all let them slide. We're naive. Is that they're not doing much or saying an awful lot about voter suppression, gerrymandering, all the corruption in that area. And that's because the money is on both sides. The billions is on both sides. You know, that's the situation. And I also, addressing fairness, in 1980, one of my trainers named Tom Hopkins said, life is not fair. And so we've got to, and I have to say this to millennials all the time. I mean, I was in Home Depot talking to millennials about voting, and they say, oh, it's not fair. I said, well, it's not fair. Right, that's correct. And here's what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to leverage it by getting involved. So I'm going to say that, the Republicans are no walk in the park. I mean, we've got to hold their feet, as you have said, over the decades, they've got to be punished. You know, that's the Utrecht C. Leeds statement. They've got to be punished. And so to expect something that's unreal, and we have to vote, okay? Some say hold your nose or whatever, yeah. But there are too many, there's a few good things happening. And we see the corruption like crazy. I don't know why we're not hearing a lot about what's happening in Atlanta, what's happening in Florida, what's happening in these states where, the real criminality is blatant, it's bold. So we've got to get involved because otherwise we have checked out and they don't care. They don't really care. Voter suppression is so great. So if we say, well, we're not voting, then they love this. They're great. Good for you.
But, I appreciate your point of view.
Thank you.
However, I think there is something more that we should expect, and you should expect that if voting is a right, how is it that we don't see enough being done to guarantee that right? I mean, pretty much voters are left on their own to see to their vote. it's your job.
Yes.
It occurs to me that there should be some overarching entity that says, we, the one thing that the United States can do that other countries simply have difficulty doing or they just don't do, is to guarantee the integrity of the process and the vote. That's not happening. I mean, the president of the United States is running this election like a thug. You know, we have a lot of thuggery going on. We have blatant, open hatred. He's stoking the flames of that. We have people's votes literally just thrown out before they even get a chance to vote. And all of this is happening supposedly in a system that guarantees the right to vote, recognizes the constitutionality of voting, and therefore recognizes the obligation of the state or some authority to guarantee the integrity of the process. Do you feel that this process is guaranteed?
Of course not, but why would it be? You know, why would they guarantee it? I mean, the people that are being affected are people with melanin. They're people that are black, brown, red, and yellow. And, you know, one of the Rockefellers said that there's 75% too many people on the planet. So we're disposable. We're people to be eliminated. And it's in our face now because they found us asleep at the post. So why would they give it to us when the money, when the PACs, Karl Rove and beyond Karl Rove, and probably from the 40s of the Israel campaigns to corrupt. If we look, they see that we are clueless. We are clueless. So let's see how much they can take. Let's see, you know, how much they'll still, and whatever it is, we will be so far ahead of it in secret that it really won't matter. It doesn't really matter. We have to make it matter. As they say, if you want something to happen, then if it's to be, it's up to you. It's up to me. If it's to be, it's up to me. If we want something to turn up, begin with our sleeves. We have to get involved, and we're not. We for some reason, our self-esteem, our self-image, our self-concept, our self-dimension, our self-potential, we are not believing how powerful we are. We got to take a page. I've said several times on League Stories is that we've got to take pages out of the Jewish playbook. Okay, they got this claim that they're the chosen people. Well, so are we. They're not chosen over us. It doesn't work that way. We have to constantly go over that affirmation, okay, or that principle that we are the chosen people, and we've got to, as I said last time I called, if we're going to vote, then we have to keep our mouth, our feet, our body in places. We've got to have somebody who's going to be designated to get involved in the block or in the building, in the community, to get there and hold them accountable. And they're not accountable because they know we're occupied by 150 channels and you know, all the nonsense. So they're not going to do it. There's no reason. And I think
looking beyond the election, beyond tomorrow, I think the very next day should begin a whole new process, an evaluation.
Absolutely.
Especially by so-called third parties or independent parties, and really assess where they can be more effective at generating interest in the electoral process.
Look what happened to Jill Stein.
That kind of analysis. I'm sorry.
Look what happened to Jill Stein and her running mate. They got going out to Long Island to participate. They were locked up. They were locked into a room. I mean, it's not going to happen. I mean, the money, again, we have allowed the corruption to come in through billions, millions and billions. That's who owns the situation now. So we don't, we can develop a third party. I agree with you. Yes, we should be developing a third party, but that's, and we should go in on this duopoly or Tweedledee Tweedledum with the mindset of creating something and finding out what it's going to take to finance it. You see, you know, Beto got all these millions because one of the things he said, hey, you know, take the knee. He was, you know, I mean, I'm sure athletes sent him all kinds of money. Okay. Because where are you getting any support for this? Not a lot. Okay. They're commercializing it, you know, but you're correct. We do need to have a third agenda. And in fact, that's going to be the agenda, actually. And the people, we've got the power, actually. We have the power, and we have to realize it and act like it and take action.
I agree. Thank you so much for getting us started today, CC. 888-874-4888. From your perspective, that's the question we are hoping to address today. From your perspective, what do you think is the most significant thing about these elections? That is, what emerges for you as the top instruction coming out of this whole process that we've witnessed over these last several months? What emerges for you as the most important thing? It doesn't have to be the right thing or the wrong thing, but the most important thing, the most significant thing that instructs or should instruct how we go from here. How do we organize our body politic to resemble as close as possible the intention of this thing called voting and the electoral process? People would say, well, you're over exaggerating. Yes, it's got kinks, it's got problems, but really, it is by far and above a decent process. You know, it's not that bad. So what do you think? Marsha from New York.
Spring Valley, hi.
Hello.
Before, I'm that 92-year-old woman who published the book, you know, From Birth to Death, The Sex in Between. I think I sent it to you. But did you ever get it?
No, I never got it.
Oh, I have to get it to you. So the reason I'm calling is because at 92 years old, I stood right next to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I've seen all the things that have happened from that time on, the things, you know, that he did for people, and his wonderful wife, Eleanor, who was very instrumental in this, put people to work and did all kinds of things. So point is, this election, I've seen things happen from Franklin Delano Roosevelt to Trump, the progression. And for the past 10 more years, I've been saying that we're headed towards fascism, because look at the movies, look at the violence, look at what we're getting young people accustomed to, seeing blood, shooting, killing. Handsome guys with lovely suits are having these big guns, and it's attractive to be shooting them, whatever. It's happening. And to get to the point, this election, for me, is against Trump, to show the people, show the world that we are smart enough and progressive enough and energized enough to vote against Trump. Get as many people into Congress as possible. And I'm still contributing to Bernie, because Bernie is helping different people get into Congress, people who are good. And so that's the issue for me, is to vote against Trump right now, because he's a very, very dangerous man. And noticing his postures that are so much like Mussolini and now Hitler, the way he poses questions, the way he presents them, and the crowds that are developed for his speeches with the hats and whatever and the signs, you know. So it is very pro Hitler right now, and so vote against Trump. Now I know that you say there's nothing to vote against. I voted Democrat. I once voted Republican for Eisenhower, I vote independent. I vote for what the best person that I think is running, and so vote against Trump right now. That's the issue. He's so dangerous. So.
So the most significant thing is for you that you've noticed the emergence, the undeniable emergence of a fascistic reality that we now have to live with, or now
yes.
are living with in terms of this Trump administration.
Yes.
And by every possible means, we should work toward his defeat, because it will be inevitable that he will go 100% down that road that he's already on.
Yes.
Wow. Is there any chance, you think, that beyond this election tomorrow, is there any chance that people will organize with that sense of urgency that you just talked about?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm hoping. You know, I can't get on lines and demonstrate physically. I send my $20, $25. I call, do what I have to do. I think that people have to do it in their community. People, whether you're Jewish or you're Black or you're Irish or you're Muslim, I'm a Buddhist, you know. I talk to people in my community. And so, you know, I grew up in a Jewish family, and in those days, Jewish people were very much in the forefront of civil rights. That's what we, you know, that's what we did. That's what we wanted to do. But it has to be in your community where you are bringing people together and saying, let's go. Bring them, show for them, carry them, whatever. Bring them to the polls. Make sure the polls are valuable, that viable, and that we can vote and have our votes count. Because you know there are things being done with machines, whatever. So you have to be vigilant at every point.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
wow.
This is a very, very dangerous time.
It is. Thank
very,
you so
very
much.
Dangerous.
Great to hear. You know what I like about your voice is just full of vibrancy. You're a vibrant sounding person. And
that's me.
It's a pleasure to hear your voice.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to get the book to you.
Thank you.
Thanks
again.
Bye.
Lincoln from Mount Vernon, you're on the air.
Hi, good day, Utrecht.
Hello, Lincoln. How are you doing?
I am, as usual, persevering.
Well, that's good. That's good. That's a positive. So what emerges for you as the most significant thing in these elections?
We are voting in oblivion. We are voting oblivious to the cause. And we are voting for symbolism. We're voting just to, it's more like an orgasm. And there's no plan to correct the system which brought about Trump. And brought about Trump, who is actually no worse than his predecessors. It's just that he is more forthright, he's more obvious than his predecessors. His predecessors were really snakes. And we're voting in ignorance, especially ignorance of the geopolitics.
But you're going really wide here, Lincoln. I'm asking for the average person. Okay, we have a sense that there's something dramatically wrong with the country. We're concerned about where it's headed. We're concerned about the leadership. We're concerned that more and more we are fearful that we don't seem to have a safe place. We're wide open and we are very vulnerable, and it's not a good feeling at all. But so let's talk to me about, you know, if you could narrow it down rather than go wide, really wide, where we can't begin to lock horns with you.
I am not fearful. And Trump doesn't make me any more fearful than Bush did. He doesn't make me any more fearful than Hillary Clinton, who had planned to create a no-fly zone over Syria, which would have caused direct conflict with Russia. I am no fearful than I was with Obama, who had plotted the Ukraine overthrow and also was planning to overthrow Syria. For example, the so-called caravan, we're not dealing with the truth of that. What about when Hillary Clinton and Obama were silent when Zelaya's was overthrown, which ended up causing the death of Bertha Caceres and also causing the worsening of the conditions of the people of Honduras? We're all dealing with lies, And unless we face those truths, we're not correcting the problem. This is just a make-believe. I think that why is it everybody is concerned about voting for black people, these black black contestants, but people like Cynthia McKinley. You didn't find black people going out and voting for someone like Cynthia McKinley, who was about real change, about really bringing about something for black people. We're voting for these little Uncle Tom blacks, and these blacks who all the, they're interested in nothing but career, just like Obama was. He was more interested in just being president rather than really bringing about truly the good of the people. And so I'm saying, and until we deal with these things, I am not scared about Trump. And especially after the wickedness they've been carrying on, and I cannot get over what they've done to Gaddafi and black people not talking about that. So I think it's all a big show. And I we're in no more danger. If they were really serious about Trump, why do they keep talking about Russia, which is one of the best things he ever done? Why do they keep demonizing him about what he did with bring about talks with North and South Korea, etc.? So it's
But what I want you to do, Lincoln, if you can stay right on topic, it would really help. The question asked is, what do you consider to be the most significant thing about these elections? What would, in one sentence, how would you, what would your summary sentence be, and then go from there?
It has brought about much excitement, but like Shakespeare, I would say much ado about nothing. I would also say it's, why are the slaves rejoicing and so busy in the slave quarters, trying to accomplish nothing but what their masters and their plantation owners are bidding them to do?
Okay.
That's it. Okay. Nice okay. Talking with you.
Well, thank you, Lincoln. Thanks for contributing today. Vincent from New York. What is your view? What is your answer to that question? What do you consider to be the most significant thing about these elections?
It seems to me the intimidation and fear factor that is being publicized by those who say you should get out and vote, who say if you don't vote, you have no voice. But you always have a voice in any situation. It's not only your human right, it's your constitutional right. If they say that you don't vote, you don't have a voice, what are they saying? You have no constitutional right? You're not a human being? I'm not voting. I'll repeat that. I'm not voting. And I'm telling others who feel the way I feel and feel in some other ways or on reasons why not to vote, don't vote. If they say that things are going to get hard for us, things are already hard for us. And I mean us, I mean black people. It's just an intimidation.
If I could ask you a follow-up question in line with the first one. Why would you consider this the most significant thing about this election?
To see how many people they can get to the polls by fear. The unknown, the increase of the police state, the increase of more firearms in the police hands, the call by non-police individuals to carry guns with them if they're licensed in houses of worship or churches. Think about it. Being in a church and knowing that there are law enforcement officers inside there with guns, and you as a worshiper don't have the right to carry a weapon outside the house of worship, nor inside. It's nothing more than an intimidation factor within the house of worship of a police state telling you to go to the polls at the barrel of a gun. So in New York City, when some houses of worship were telling the black community to turn over their firearms illegal to the houses of worship so they can so-called stop the violence in the black community. Look at it now. you see more law enforcement officers taking the lives of black people within the community, unarmed, no firearms. You have a right to bear arms under the United States Constitution. It doesn't say you have to have a license. You have the right to protect yourself by nature. So when they say, let's say that a vote has been taken and we come to abuse you and you must accept this abuse because we took a vote, you're a fool to accept the abuse. You have every right to defend yourself.
But I will ask you a question that is frequently directed at me. If you're not voting, you're not participating, aren't you making the case that you are avoiding an opportunity to make a difference by expressing, in fact, a constitutional right to influence how government will work and function?
Well, I feel that I'm speaking by not going to the polls and having others like me not go to the polls and increasing those numbers, because they look at that. They look at the registered voters, the non-registered voters, and they also look at the increase of population within the voting districts. You know, the people who don't vote, who live under the bridges, the people who don't vote that live in the train stations or the train tunnels, the people who don't vote, who don't have an address of a residence but might have a P.O. box. You know, people like that, the people that the politicians, before they get into office and become politicians, don't reach out to. They want you to give them something so they can say, oh, I can't help you now, I'm too busy working, doing the job you put me in office to do, in a system that's not functioning to benefit the people. Do something for me before you ask me to support you. Show me some love and support before you ask me to give it up first.
Well, all right. You made yourself clear. You made it plain. Thank you, Vincent, for contributing to the discussion today. From Rosedale, Jose, you're on the air.
Greetings, as always, my professor. How are you?
Hello, Jose.
Well, you asked a question that I just tuned in, by the way, so I'm not too up on most of what you've been saying. But the little I gather is that I see this election to me means the further constriction of the system. It is like circling the wagons. This is an election that is going to determine how deep into hell that the system is going to take the people. How much are we going to accept from the system? And Trump is a standard bearer of evil. And he and his cabal they're all set to take us into a direction that this country don't want to go. They don't want to go. And I see, because there's not much, a whole lot of difference between that faction of the government and the Democratic faction. I see the Democrats as taking us there at a slower pace. But the Republicans under this fellow here is planning to accelerate the direction in which we're going. But I really want to say this, my professor. I've heard time and time again about the alliances between the Jewish community and the African American community in this country, and in the civil rights movement. Everywhere I go, people are always telling me of the contribution of the Jewish community with the civil rights and so forth. And to me, I believe that what the Jewish contribution to the civil rights movement to me, was not a humongous contribution, because majority of the Jewish community was not a part of the civil rights movement. And whatever gains that was made...
You realize you're straying from the topic.
I know, but I have to get this out of my chest, my professor, because I've just yesterday, I've been faced with and heard one of your callers not too long ago mention about the alliances with the Jewish people to the civil rights movement. And it just seemed as if they did it all by themselves. And for me, the Jewish people have to understand that what is happening today, what these boys are doing, it was not just aimed at people of color. That they had horses in the race too. And they were saving their skins. They were not in it because of the love of black folks. They were in it to save their skin, because they're seeing what is happening today.
Jose, I'm getting concerned about you now. You just bring it down a couple of notches so I can hardly hear you.
Okay, all right. Now, this struggle, this civilized struggle that we have had, you know, the Jewish people, some of them have been involved in it, yes, but not to the degree that they want us to feel. And if there was a real alliance between the Jewish community and the African-American community, African-American would not be in the condition that we are in this country. If you look at the cities and the community where we live, what is happening?
Let me just address what you're saying so far. Number one, the number one error that we make in analyzing the relationship between African Americans and Jews in the United States is to see it as a kind of, you know, a wide open thing in which you apply standards just willy-nilly. And that's not the case. That's not the way it works. In every community, you see it in the black community. The black community is no way monolithic. It does not agree wholeheartedly with one position or the other. There's a great deal of factionalism, and that's historic. In struggle, anywhere in the world, you find a great deal of friction and factionalism, because people are coming from entirely different ideological perspectives. So you can't say blacks are so and so and so and make a general statement even about blacks. The black community is splintered. The black community, in fact, there is a core to it, but that does not mean that the way a black person feels or the way a black person acts is the way all black persons feel and act. We encounter this every time there is a crisis in the black community. The Jewish community is absolutely not a monolith. There are all kinds of Jews from all kinds of traditions, all kinds of religious beliefs. So it's not a monolith. But we should not use a blanket, attribute a blanket behavior to the Jewish community. Understand that the Jewish community is not by any means a monolith. Now, I've covered Crown Heights, for example, for a long time. And I can tell you about the wars. I mean, actual physical confrontations and attacks and crimes being committed between and among different religious factions, including kidnappings and murder. You would never believe that. So people see the community in Crown Heights as a monolithic group. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And you see also a friction between the religious community and the non-religious community. That's an ongoing friction within the Jewish, what we consider the Jewish community. It is not a monolith. by any means. So we also should not negate the role that many Jews, they fit all kinds of profiles within the Jewish community, non-religious, liberal, some are conservative, but many have placed themselves on the line in the so-called civil rights movement. But I agree with you. We have to, we can't negate the fact that in many ways we see the, quote, the Jewish community acting against the interests of blacks. But I want to caution that we don't accept that label, because in that sense, you will find out that the Jewish community is very complex. The black community has had great strategic help from many Jews. They are not considered part of the Jewish community. They're not. They're castigated. They are demonized. They are, I mean, you take Bill Kunstler, the late Bill Kunstler, who was a lawyer representing very unpopular clients, very unpopular causes, and absolutely pilloried by Jews, called a traitor, all kinds of nasty things that he had to endure. Stanley Cohen is another lawyer. I know many who have worked tirelessly in the name of freedom fighters and in the name of liberation, who are just lumped into this thing called the Jewish community. We got to be more sophisticated now and be able to distinguish what do we mean by the Jewish community. If we took notice with this bombing, not bombing, but the mass shooting, what will we see? We see this Jewish religious community is very different from many Jewish religious communities. They have a different orientation, and we have to understand that. You disagree?
Professor, they, from the beginning, they ought to have known that the folks who really run this place is not only after us, but they're after them also. That's why I say this alliance that we have had, they have benefited tremendously from it also. But the truth be told, it is not a large number of Jewish people that actually supported black people. And many of them feel the same way about us that the enemies feel about us.
But yes, but look at the logic.
That the enemy is after us and is after them.
Yes, but this is the way we have to correctly interpret the situation. We can't jump to conclusions that all Jews do this in the same way that many people say all blacks are that. We have to grow beyond that now and understand the fine details of what we're working with. If many Jews were very helpful in the civil rights movement, I agree. But don't get angry now. We have to be very clear. They did their part. Those who were involved, they did their part. It is up to black people to see to their own liberation. Why do we expect other people to liberate us? I don't get that. Why is it the job of somebody to be more interested, more invested in our welfare than we are? That is crazy. It is convenient to say somebody else is responsible or somebody else didn't do whatever. But look, what does the record show? You have it within your power to see to your own liberation, and all oppressed people have to confront this central issue. You're responsible for your own liberation. Period. If you get help, hip hip hooray. But you should neither expect it nor believe that it is in fact the case that somebody else should come in and save you. No, that's your job. Your survival is your job, nobody else's. Okay? We have to see the situation for what it really is. I can't be angry because my neighbor is not doing what I consider to be his part in my liberation. My liberation is my responsibility. If he helps me, if he agrees to help me fix up my house, if he helps me to walk the dog, these things are great. But if essentially, they have nothing to do with your liberation, or very little. Your job, that's your job, my job, our job, nobody else's. And we really have to get to learn how different, how very different this thing we lump together and call the Jewish community. You really need to know how different the Jewish community is, like I've said before. The first Seder, the person who taught me about the Seder, was a Jamaican friend of mine, a Jew who came from a long line of Jews going all the way back to Ethiopia. She's a Jew. She comes from a very healthy community of Ethiopian and African and Jamaican Jews. Nobody probably gives a thought to the fact that there is such a thing as a Jamaican Jew. But there she is, fluent in Hebrew, fluent in Torah. She in fact had to instruct her own rabbi. So we have to develop an entirely different construct about this notion that we have in our heads about any particular community. Any particular community. It is not a monolith. Thanks a lot. Well, believe it or not, that brings us to the end of our program today. Some really good and vibrant discussion. And let's see what tomorrow brings at the polls and otherwise. Thanks for listening. Keep it right here at PRN.FM. Bye-bye. I'm talking people about the